Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to writer and musician Josh Allen Friedman, brother of Drew and Kip, son of Bruce J. Now, it was going to be a pretty casual conversation until his friend, Screw Magazine publisher Al Goldstein, died on December 18, 2013. Josh co-authored Goldstein's memoir, I, Goldstein, My Screwed Life, so we'll talk about that, as well as Black Cracker and Tales of Times Square. He'll also perform a couple of songs, if you play your cards right. Stick around. I think I'm ready to start inviting Friedman women on the show next.
Here's one now.
That's a cutie.
This is Amy Grace Friedman, and she's pulling to get down.
Okay, okay, Amy. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that finds foul language, racial name-calling, graphic violence, and inconsequential sexual proclivities attractive in a guy like you, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Al Goldstein broke the mold of the men's magazine publisher. In an industry in which Playboy magazine founder Hugh Hefner was that nice pornographer next door, Penthouse's Bob Guccione Sr. was its Caligula, and Hustler's Larry Flint was the equivalent of comedy's Gallagher II, Screw magazine publisher Al Goldstein was off the charts ridiculous and scandalous frequently at the same time. But in many ways, Goldstein, described in the headline of his New York Times obituary as a publisher who took the romance out of sex, was also the most human of the bunch, never seeking to elevate himself through his sex rag so much as to use it to expose a world of hypocrisy and bullshit. He also endeared himself to a legion of loyal followers, employees, and creative types, typically New Yorkers, because he was one of them. Now, Goldstein died on Thursday, December 18th, at a nursing home in Cobble Hill, Brooklyn. He was 77. And my guest today, Josh Allen Friedman, was already scheduled to be on the show before Goldstein's passing. He is my fourth Friedman male, following his brothers Drew and Kip and father Bruce J. My original plan was to talk strictly about Josh's unique body of work, from his autobiographical novel, Black Cracker, and sordid but true collection, Tales of Times Square, to his sonic compositions, including a musical based on the life of the world's worst film director, Ed Wood, appropriately titled The Worst. Now, we'll still talk about most of all that, but we'll shift our focus to Al Goldstein, with whom Josh wrote the Screw Magazine publisher's autobiography, I, Goldstein, My Screwed Life. And stay tuned for two, that's right, not one, but two exclusive performances of original compositions written and performed by Josh. Josh Allen Friedman, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hello, Bob. Hello, Mr. Media. Great to be here.
Jazz hands? Are we getting jazz hands?
Jazz hands. I have a young daughter who's a ballet dancer, so occasionally I go to shows in which there are jazz hands.
Okay. So you can see why we like to have video on the show.
Yes.
Yeah, we got the whole thing. Let's talk and let's frame your relationship a little with Al Goldstein from the outset here. How did it begin? How did you get involved with him?
When I was a young lad, being in the very early 70s, and began to notice Screw magazine around the East Village outside the Fillmore East, my father bought it a few times, and of course, I found it somewhere hidden in a corner of the office. It was shocking. It was hysterically funny. And it was like Mad Magazine for adults, a pornographic Mad Magazine for adults, spearheading, as we now think of it in a pretentious way, it was sort of the sword of the sexual revolution. So when I was 14, 15 and would see it, it would be really an arresting thing to see. And I began to become a fan of it, and a few years later submitted my very first writing piece when I was 19 or 20 to Screw. And at a moment, in the one moment in my life, one of the low points, when my mother actually kicked me out of the apartment. I was about 20 years old, and I was thrown out for a few days. I think I insulted her new boyfriend or something right after my parents separated. I went to a Fleabag hotel in Times Square, which is where I felt I belonged, where I heard vomiting out in the alley through the night. It was like an $8 room. And I felt like I was at the end of my life at the age of 20. And I went out and bought a copy of Screw to see what was going on in the neighborhood in Times Square. This would have been 1976. Lo and behold, I cracked open the Screw, and there was my byline and the piece I had submitted months earlier.
Wow.
So it was one of the most uplifting moments of my life, having been thrown out for just for a few days. In a Fleabag hotel in Times Square, 20 years old, thinking that I'm an old bum and this is what my life has come to, but then seeing I'm in Screw magazine, my piece. I don't think I've ever enjoyed a publication as much as that first time. When your first time seeing yourself published. So that made a very deep impact on my life. And within just a couple of years, I was a year later, I was doing assignments for them.
Two things strike me. One, I think that the story of you being thrown out of your mother's apartment is in Kip's book,
probably
Barracuda in the Attic.
Yeah.
Boy.
My mother was not someone prone to throwing her children out into the streets. This was just a momentary blow-up that occurred right at the time when my parents split up and a boyfriend came in to live with three teenage sons, the audacity of that. And I think I said something uncouth to him, like, get the fuck out of here. What are you doing here? You know, my mother came after me with a frying pan right out the apartment and into the street and said, get out of here. You know.
Hard to imagine you saying anything uncouth. I don't know how that could have happened.
Well, I was, I was 20 years old and I hadn't, I was like a rich street kid is the way I would look at it now, you know, like a rich street kid. I learned on the streets, but came from what I guess was a well-to-do family somewhat, you know, so.
Did you ever ask Al later why he picked up on your piece initially? If that was the first time you were published, I have to ask, did your father's name have anything to do with the?
Oh, no, there wouldn't have been any. This came totally from the slush pile. Nobody would have known who my father was in that case. And at that point, by the mid-70s, Al Goldstein was not hands-on editing the magazine. He was the rich, famous publisher about town, the man about town, doing public, you know, the way a governor of New York or Texas would be. It doesn't really do the governing. He just makes appearances and stuff. So Al was he owned it. He was there every day, but he had editor, you know, a whole staff. There were 30 people who worked there at Screw and Midnight Blue, at least 30. Employees and very good editors, all of whom went on to other magazines. And of course, the art department would always graduate to the New York Times after learning how to work with smeary newsprint at Screw, and then they would get jobs at the Times. So we were all smart guys and mostly college educated guys, except me. I didn't go to college. I'm the only one who didn't. But we'd get our nightmares out on paper, and we're the opposite of what you would imagine to be, you know, what the public imagination would be. I don't know, murderers in raincoats, you know, slinking into movie theaters. You know, they were just young family men who were writers and editors and starting out their careers.
Now, for people who were not on the East Coast in the 70s, in the early 80s, I guess. And never actually saw Screw, because I know even growing up in New Jersey, you rarely saw it on the newsstands in New Jersey, but you always saw it prominently displayed on the newsstands in New York. Can you explain the magazine a little bit? What would somebody find there in the mid to late 70s?
Well, Screw magazine was first published The first issue actually came out the week that President Nixon was elected president in 1968. The week he was sworn in is when the first issue came out. It was a weekly newspaper in New York that at its peak sold a few hundred thousand copies a week, primarily in New York City. It was on every newsstand for many, many years, right next to the New York Post, yes, at the front of every newsstand in New York City, piled high. It was the New York Post and Screw right out front, and then a thousand other magazines and newspapers behind it, including the Times.
Was Screw ever to the left of New York Post, so it'd be like Screw the New York Post?
It could be in the left or the right, but they'd usually be like the late edition of the Post, and there's this week's Screw piled up right out front of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of newsstands. So I was always very proud of that in the subways and everything, that whatever cover line I had come up with, if it was a line like, you know, Armageddon and Dingleberries or Sex and Diarrhea, I'd have a big cover line, and I knew that millions of New Yorkers had to see that in their face every, you know. Now, the covers themselves were not pornographic. They were very often, they were done by great cartoonists, underground cartoonists. Robert Crumb did covers, Spain, Art Spiegelman, Drew Friedman, my brother, did. Once I got there, I became obsessed with getting the Three Stooges on the cover.
We're going to come to that. Don't give that away yet. We're going to come to that.
Okay. Right. So they were not offensive to, you know, I was never advocated putting pornography or nudity in front of somebody's face who didn't want to see it. As much as I was involved in that culture in the 70s when it was underground and semi-legal, even illegal, I mean, people got busted and arrested for pornography then. It was really dirty. Considered dirty then, and it was very subversive at that time. But I never wanted, like, my wife to see it, who was then my girlfriend. I didn't like it on the streets in people's faces, but I always thought it belonged on 42nd Street. And let New York City have just one street out of, you know, it's just 13 blocks in New York. It was Times Square. Let that be the red light district. And even there, keep it out of the storefronts. You got to walk in past the divider. So I think democratically, everyone should be allowed to see it and have it, who needs it. And those who don't want to see it should not have it in their face.
And then once you opened Screw, what did people find?
Well, then all hell broke.
Exactly.
Then you're on your own, man. Once you bought the copy and got it. It was many things. Al considered it primarily a political newspaper. Well, he ran the very first hooker ads on the newsstand anywhere. So for the first time in thousands of years, prostitutes had an advertising medium before the public. He went to jail for that. He ran the first dildo ads so that now your Aunt Murgatroyd can buy a vibrator at the corner drugstore. Al went to jail for that. He was arrested and spent the weekend in jail for running dildo ads. The Supreme Court of Manhattan charged in court that dildos could be used for criminally immoral purposes. So somebody had to be the first to do that. And in many regards, Al Goldstein was the man who did it, and his partner, Jim Buckley. They were arrested over 20 times within the first 2 years, where they were put in handcuffs and brought down to jail. Al Goldstein showed the first full frontal nudity on a newsstand publication in America. It had only been available as underground pornography, which was a rich man's domain. It was very expensive and was bought like heroin, or like in an opium den or something. You know, pornography in the 1950s was something very secretive, very illegal, and that only a rich person could afford. Primarily, there were stag films also. Uh-huh. Al put it in newsprint. He went to jail for it. Pubic hair at one time. He was arrested once for showing pubic hair.
Not his own.
Well, eventually his own. They should have arrested him for showing his own, actually. You know, that was the on the charge of disgustingness. But the first arrest Screw suffered or enjoyed, if it was Goldstein, he enjoyed being arrested. It was a great pleasure for him, was 8 hours after putting Mayor Lindsay's erection, a composite of Mayor Lindsay with an erection, in the paper. And that was the first time the NYPD raided Screw's office and took Goldstein out in handcuffs. Mm. The mayor tried to put Goldstein out of business. So all of Goldstein's opponents, and there were hundreds, seemed to go down in flames, either in court or in life. Mm-hmm. It was almost, it was like voodoo, it seemed to me. Here's a like a Hebrew pit bull who's, if I wouldn't say that he was the defender of the First Amendment. The First Amendment may have been his defender, but he was the one who tested it and flexed the First Amendment's muscles more than any other publisher in America to see how far the First Amendment will go, freedom of the press. And he made it go far, and he proved how strong it really is. And he did go to jail, and he faced 60 years in prison. Him and Jim Buckley, his partner at that time, who he bought out after a few years. The feds tried to put Goldstein and Buckley in jail for 60 years, and it really looked like they were going to go. And they were convicted, and the great lawyer, Harold Price Feringer, the great First Amendment lawyer, was able to get it, was able to have that overturned, and they were freed in the late 70s, around the time I came to work for them.
Now, tell me a little bit about Goldstein's, his mentality, if you will. I mean, for example, was he challenging the First Amendment because he wanted to challenge the First Amendment, or was he testing boundaries? And I'll give you an example. We think about that for a second. Years ago, I did a book. This is a weird one to bring in, but I did a book with the founders of the Home Depot, and they had for their employees what they called the electric fence. And the idea of the electric fence was you can go as far as you possibly think you need to go. And if you go too far, you'll hit the electric fence, you'll get a shock, and you'll know that that's as far as you should go. Is that – I mean, does that kind of describe him? And was he doing it –
He went – I would think that Al Goldstein was an out of control – he had more neuroses than anybody imaginable. He was on every – he had took enough medications to kill 10 Elvises. He was an out-of-control pig in many ways, in that he, the more successful he got, the more money he made, the more he became obsessed with instant gratification, sex, food, gadgets, TVs, computers that he didn't even open. He spent himself into the gutter, which comes up later. But part of that was a fearlessness that I was awed by. I had, as a young guy in my 20s, many times stood next to this fat, middle-aged Jew who was not an athletic man and saw him face down the mob, the government, the police, anybody, face down prison sentences to the point where I thought he was the bravest man I'd ever encountered in my life. Recklessly brave, but truly brave and fearless. Mm. And you talk about who's the toughest Jew in New York, or the toughest, you know, he was tougher than Ariel Sharon in many ways, you know. Now, he was also a fool. He also had no care about his own dignity. He was able to put himself, he always related to the common man, even when he was a very rich man. He had a big townhouse on the Upper East Side. His neighbor was Bill Cosby. And his parties in the 1970s and 80s at his East Side townhouse with his wife, Gina, and he had a young son, Jordan, and servants, and he had a full-time bodyguard who was John Flynn, who was his chauffeur bodyguard, was a former New York City vice cop detective who had once busted blind Screw news dealers. And Goldstein eventually hired him for many years as his chauffeur, bodyguard, John Flynn. He was a great guy. But the parties at his house seemed to me like you could have been at a party at the French embassy. Hmm. They were white collar, everybody in suit and tie, servants with trays of hors d'oeuvres. drinks, and everybody, you know, an Upper East Side, upper crust society from all walks of life, you know, show business. And I remember there were certain, there was a couple of times where I invited a woman, like, come on over to one of Al's parties, you know, and they assumed it would be in a dungeon somewhere. And if I tell you, it was like being at the French embassy at his house.
Cosby, now, Cosby ever joined the party?
Yeah, sometimes Cosby, really? Cosby would come to the screw parties. And Al was very, you know, Cosby was so very gracious. Al never pressured him to be in screw or everything. But I think Cosby got a kick out of it. And also, just as a decent man, Cosby just seemed to be it was just friends with Al as a neighbor, you know. So there would always be people at our screw editorial meetings when I was senior editor there in 1980, 81, 82. Every week at our editorial meeting, Al would have a special guest come in and sit in. So one week it was Melvin Van Peebles.
Wow.
Another week it was Philip Roth, who spent 3 days there observing us. Mm. He based a character in one of his books on Goldstein. Abbie Hoffman, when he was on the run, when he was on the lam, hiding out, came into a screw editorial meeting when I was there. So there were always people from outside of the business. There would also be porn stars who would come. But it was a unique publication in New York history. It lasted for 35 years, 1,800 issues. And with all the magazines I've worked for and at, I think my father probably, my parents would have liked it if I went to The New Yorker when I was young. But not everybody could work at The New Yorker. And for some reason, Goldstein just looked like a hero to me, and I was drawn to him. Hmm. I was really drawn to him.
Well, of course, your dad and Mario Puzo worked at some men's magazines in the 60s.
In the 50s.
50s, I'm sorry.
And through to the mid-60s, yes. Well, that's how writers made a living, Pulp Fiction. My dad was editor of five different magazines on Madison Avenue in the 50s. And then he did his real writing at night. He didn't even write for the magazines. He thought up the ideas and assigned them to writers. Male, Men, Man's World. They were for World War II vets. And there are many tribute books to those that come out now. There's one that we just did, I did with my publisher, Wyatt Doyle, based on the cover called Weasels Ripped My Flesh, a famous men's cover from the 50s, and he named the compilation book Weasels Rip My Flesh. So it has my father in it and Mario in it and interviews I've done with writers from that era. So many writers came, great writers came through those magazines. So in the 70s and 80s, I mean, it was the end of the men's magazine era, and that's where I was able to earn a living when I was in my 20s, you know, working for all those magazines. But Screws was secretly... It was the font from which everything else seemed to come, even though it wasn't really national.
Now you mentioned earlier some of the great and underground at the time artists who came through. Your brother Drew, Art Spiegelman. What about some of the writers? Because it seems to me that there were a lot of writers we all would recognize now that went through those doors as well at times.
There were more artists for some reason who came through Screw who went on to become prominent. Mm-hmm. Or were prominent, a lot more artists than writers. Okay. For some reason. Some of the writers, I mean, there were still hundreds of writers who did a piece for Screw at some point who would have a recognizable name. I mean, I think even Philip Roth did one piece. And in the early days, I remember Germaine Greer did a piece called Lady Love Your C-U-N-T. She did a few pieces. The Screw interviews would always be fascinating because they would get people like Sammy Davis Jr. or Joe Namath or Jack Nicholson back in 1970, 71, 72, giving a pornographic interview about their sex life for the first time.
Before the internet
and before any other magazine would have touched upon such a thing. John Lennon in 1969 gave an interview to Screw talking about his sex life as a child, you know, with his first experiences and stuff. I mean, it seems innocent in today's, but back then it was outrageous to talk about that and to show that. It had not been showed in a newsstand publication before, those kind of pictures. Stuff that now that is on the Disney Channel practically.
Practically.
Well, it's worse on the Disney show.
Yeah, it's something.
But the Disney actors, the kids who go through Disney, you know, are a lot raunchier than we were 35 years ago now.
I think that's safe to say. Let me ask you this. So in the introduction, I did my best to distinguish Goldstein from Hefner and Guccione and Flint. How would you distinguish them? I suspect you'd be a little more accurate than I could ever.
Well, I don't know. Two of them went down in flames, being Bob Guccione and Al Goldstein, meaning they both were once very powerful men, who were very wealthy men, particularly Guccione, who was worth probably over $200 million at one point, and ended up in a trailer park in Florida with cancer. In hiding, basically, in the last 10 years of his life. I think he finally, in his last month, he came up to Dallas. Some friend of his took pity, flew him up here, and he died quietly and out of the limelight. So how the mighty fall, it's extraordinary. And Goldstein, of course, being a very wealthy man, ended up literally in the gutter for a year, living in the streets of New York as New York's most famous street person. And he did it to himself. He was not assassinated. He was never martyred for his cause. He spent himself into the gutter. He literally, like an out-of-control pig escaping from a pig pen, spent every cent that came in through Screw over the years, and to the point where he lost everything. All of his homes, his cars, his wives, his family, his magazine, Midnight Blue. He lost everything and was living in Bellevue Men's Shelter and on the street. I remember looking for him one night about 8 years ago, where we didn't know where he was for months, and going out with friends in a car, going from men's shelter in New York City. We could not locate him. And somebody would see him on the street with a cup of coffee, sitting in a, you know. So it's like Dickens could not have written, or Shakespeare. It goes beyond. And that's what Al Goldstein was about, was being beyond. It makes for an incredible story, and yet a terrible life, ultimately. In the end, a terrible life. Now, Larry Flint was an imitator of Al Goldstein, and a great one, because he started Hustler magazine 6 years after Screw, and it was sort of like taking the Screw ethic. I didn't think it was as funny or as brilliant as Screw was,
no,
although it had its moments, certainly, but taking it into full color and showing women, you know, the gynecological side of women, and taking it national, and became a phenomenon of sorts. Flint is also a very brave man, and he did also tested the First Amendment in ways that, like Al Goldstein, I think, following Al, and they were very good friends. And Hefner, of course, is the guy who started everything. I mean, he's the and has outlived. Well, he and Flint are still alive, but Hefner still. I mean, he may be seem like a fool. Being 80 in his late 80s and surrounded by women in their 20s, but wouldn't we all like to be that kind of fool? I think everybody who looks at Hefner as a fool and thinks he's making an idiot of himself would certainly not mind trading places with that.
I'll be careful what I say here, because I never know when my wife might watch one of these shows, but of course. So let me ask you this. How did you go from being 20 years old, spending a couple nights in a Times Square flophouse, discovering your byline in Screw magazine, to being his co-author on his memoir, I. Goldstein?
Well, I became, I was writing for the Soho News. I started writing for Penthouse. And at the moment, I think I went, I was trying to get into Saturday Night Live the first year that their staff changed. And I was at the staff meetings, and that would have been around 1979, 1980. And there are a few people tried to get me in there, and I didn't get in, and I felt crushed. And as a consolation job, an opening at Screw came up, and I needed a job, and I thought, this is the pits. I could have been at Saturday Night Live this year, and now I'm ending up at Screw. Oh, my God. And I'm 20, in my early 20s. Well, as it turned out, that job at Screw quickly turned into a magnificent experience. Nobody would imagine, you know, I mean, the Lord works in mysterious ways. And you can find God in the gutter, is what I found out. The whisper of the Lord, you know, in places like Times Square. Whereas at Saturday Night Live, everybody who worked there in that first year where the cast changed and the writers changed had nervous breakdowns, and it was the worst flop season of their lives that year. So I ended up at the right place. It opened up Times Square to me, which I eventually did a book about. I met my wife Peggy when I worked there because it turned out nobody had noticed until me that Screw was overlooking the Markle Evangeline Hall run by the Salvation Army for young women from the South coming up to be to college or to be ballet dancers in New York. And I noticed all these girls in the window right outside the our 11th floor. That's what we faced out on. So I met my wife through the window there. And as I've written about this, but I called her. I got her to scream out her number from the window. It was her second day in New York from Littlefield, Texas. And she said, well, who are y'all? I said, first thing, don't ever give out your number in New York like that. Thank God you gave it to me.
Right.
She said, well, who are you? I said, well, we're Screw Magazine. If you had been across from Time Life, you would have really fallen in with some perverts.
folks, it's a great story. It's in Tales of Times Square. Just
I think it's in the Sex When Sex Was Dirty book. It's a long ago anecdote. Here we are 33 years later in Dallas.
Still holds up.
But I met my best friend, Richard Giacoma, who was managing editor there at the same time I came in, and some great writers like Gil Revell, went on to write an anti-pornography book after he worked for Goldstein for the far right. He got this book deal where he became like a anyway. But we had a great team there, and it became a magnificent 2 years that I was there. So little by little, Goldstein started to notice me. I was just one of 30 employees, but my pieces seemed to stand out. I took them very seriously. I did little tours of Times Square, and I covered the Naked City listings, which were 250 establishments in New York City at that time, none of which still exist, that were the peep shows, the massage parlors, the swing clubs, the porno theaters, my favorite, the burlesque halls, which are all gone, like the Melody Burlesque. This is like a place where you go in there and it felt like Abbott, you know, guys like Abbott and Costello there with top hats, you know, and it was the very last days of the old burlesque. So it was like a Damon Runyon, you know, guys, the old men, elevator men, men in their 70s, and demented young starlets. And it was an amazing scene. I loved it. Al started to notice me through that, and we became closer and started going to dinner with him. And I guess by the time he was on the streets, I was the last man standing as a former employee out of hundreds. I was like, because I'd never stayed very close to him, I kept my distance, didn't give him a chance to. You wouldn't want to be one of his personal secretaries, but he was a great boss to work for if you're a young writer, and he just gave you carte blanche to go do whatever you want, write whatever you wanted. And with an expense account, so it was an amazing
even better
thing, you know. And then when he was on the streets, at some point he got in touch with me and said, is there anything you can do? Is there any way, any kind of money? Can I get a book deal? Can you get? And I went to work and I did an outline, and it took a year. And as he was coming off the streets, we had a book deal for his autobiography.
Was it? Were you surprised by anything when he peeled back that curtain and let you in?
No. I had been – like I'd seen him in action as an employee quietly for the last few years, as both as a freelance writer there, and then I was actually there for 2 years like full time. But I was the freelance writer for 5, 6, or 7 – I had a column, you know, the Naked City listings. And I would go out with him into Times Square and stuff and see him in action and always be awed by his behavior. I never saw anything like it. I remember the most beautiful porn actress in the entire business back then, Annette Haven, coming up to the Screw office. And I never saw a man grovel for a blowjob in my life the way Al did, on his knees, following her out to her limousine and down 14th Street, following the limousine, begging for a blow. And she was laughing and saying, "Oh, Al, oh, Al." But many a time I'd seen the most heroic rejections I've ever seen in my life foisted upon this man who had no shame and would ask anything, you know, of anybody, you know. And a lot of times he scored, you know. A lot of times he scored, and that would be equally amazing. You know, he had all the porn stars of that era, of that great era of the 1970s. He scored with practically all of them, you know, because he was so.
Well, let me ask you about his obituary and the Three Stooges. You and Al each had a desire for something, and they both came true in the New York Times obituary. Can you tell that story?
Well, in Goldstein's final 10 years, he would very often, when we'd go out to dinner or arrange a table of people in New York, you know, he would – the only thing that mattered to him, he knew he was going to die. He knew he outlived already 30 years beyond where he thought, you know, – there was so many, he got so many death threats. Every morning there'd be death threats on his message machine. He would laugh them off. He would go on TV and just dare, you know, he'd say, "I know there are assassins out there who are looking for me, and I've got, you know, take your best shot. You know, you're also, you know, you're inborn hillbilly." He'd say in Cincinnati or something, he'd call them hillbillies who he knew that they could only miss. They didn't even have good aim. Try and hit them, you know. So it was amazing he never got shot. Flint got shot instead, Larry Flint. But he knew he was going to die in the last 10 years at any time. He was in such bad shape. And he would, all he cared about was that they would include a picture in his obituary. If all, you know, and he would tell everybody else, "If you die in your obituary, you won't have a picture, but I will, or I better have one." And that's all he, it meant so much to him. Well, the day that he died, not only did he get a picture in his obituary, but he was on the cover of the New York Times. And I had gotten a call from the Times the night before, and they asked me to choose a Screw cover. Could I send them one? And I picked the Three Stooges, done by an artist named John Mariano, who was very close. He kind of imitated Drew. A lot of people thought Drew did that cover, but it was actually John Mariano. It took him like a year to do that cover. It's from 1982. I was very proud of that cover. I loved that cover. And I was touched almost to tears, not quite to tears, but almost to tears, that I was asked by the Times to pick. And there it was on the cover of the New York Times 2 weeks ago with Al's picture and his obituary, with a heroic obituary, a huge obituary in the Times, seen across the world. So we both got what we want. I always wanted the Stooges on the cover. He wanted his picture. Two dreams of two idiots through in one.
And I imagine that your brother Drew, who loves the Stooges probably as much as you, he was very proud of you for accomplishing that, and was just kicking himself it wasn't his Three Stooges that was on the cover of the
New York Times. I have to say, I did send them like three covers, and one of them was that I didn't have that many that were already scanned. You know, they needed an instant cover. You know, one of the covers was a Drew. One of my favorite covers was Drew's Dwight Frye. He did an amazing picture of Dwight Frye, who was the Dracula's Count Dracula's slave boy. If you remember that face, it was a, you know,
yes,
kind of face. And Drew did that as a cover of Screw, and I did send that too, but it wasn't family friendly like
like the Stooges
cover. So it could have been Drew's cover.
Got it.
But they put the Stooges on. I knew they would, because they needed a family friendly.
Yeah.
Cover of Screw, you know. I think Drew's cover said "Psycho Sex" on that picture, you know, and they
that might not have been their cup of tea.
They had to run one that old ladies could say, "How nice." Three Stooges.
I remember picking up that Three Stooges issue when I bought my first vibrator. I found the ad in Screw.
Right.
So I think we could probably go on for quite a long time about Al and
well, now they could make the movie and stuff. The book is called I, Goldstein, and it's I became Al Goldstein through that. He was coming off the streets when we wrote it, and I used his editorials, and I had, as it turned out, I had files of information from my days at Screw and hundreds of memories, plus his editorials and his quotes and his, you know, he didn't participate in the writing of it that much, but it is him, his quotes, his thoughts, when he read it, he was, when he read the finished book, he was blown away. He said, this is me, this is perfect, this is exactly what I say, how I feel, except for a few minor details. And so that is the representation of Al Goldstein, all in that book. I try and protect his legacy in to what is important about what he did, because so much of what he did was excessive insanity, mm-hmm. and is not and was just self-destruction. Ultimately, he self-destructed beyond anybody in his position to end up on the streets. But what he did in his first years at Screw, his first decade at Screw or two, was really important, and I believe. So I think that's clarified in the book.
I think you mentioned on your Facebook page that someone like Paul Giamatti would play him in the movie today. But I actually thought, and maybe I'm giving credit to the wrong person, I thought maybe you had written that, but maybe it was someone.
I think I did. That would be the type of guy. As a matter of fact, there's another guy who was even – okay, who was the second actor in the new Scorsese film? The fat guy.
Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill, when the first time he says, fuck you, in The Wolf of Wall Street, I saw a young Al Goldstein there. And for the rest of the film, I imagined Jonah Hill as Al Goldstein.
See, now I got to dispute that with you. I'm thinking that's the role that Artie Lang was born to play.
Well, could Artie Lang do it now? Is he in shape to do it? That's the point. Al always wanted Richard Dreyfuss, but Dreyfuss is probably 70 now, and you know.
Well, maybe Jonah Hill plays the young Al, Artie Lang plays the middle-aged Al, and you still get Richard Dreyfuss to get him at the end of his life.
That would be perfect, wouldn't it? But it would have that would be on Broadway, where they do things like that.
Yeah,
in a movie that would be a little bit of a stretch.
All right. Well, okay.
He always said from the beginning, like Lenny Bruce, that he would never be invited to the movie, to the premiere of his own movie, which was true. He's too crazy to allow in. Now they can do it now that he's not here.
Yeah. Well, all right. So let's bridge this gap, this time that we spent with Al, and I want to talk about some other things that are not Goldstein related. But to get to that point, I was hoping you might play a song for us.
Let's do it.
All right. One.
I have a couple of brand new ones.
Excellent.
And I'll just let this explain itself. Thanks.
the heaven ring, love at first sight. Looks like your mama, it's a Turkish delight. Countrymen, lend me your ear. Don't be fooled by my fair skin, derriere. Ooh, yeah. Cause if you don't dig this, baby, you can kiss my big black ass. My big black ass. My big black ass. My big black ass. Big black ass, my big black ass, my big black ass, my big black ass.
All right.
There you go.
First time, right?
I think so, yeah.
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 That was awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, from the man who gave you Black Cracker in print, you can kiss his big black ass.
Give it a kiss. For some reason, a lot of my titles have black in it. You know, I have black. My song "Blacks and Jews" is probably my best known song in Texas, where I play. Black Cracker, the book. I had another record that got a lot of play in Texas years ago called "Black Queen," a Steve Stills song. So, and now "Kiss My Big Black Ass." So, I have a thing going with titles with black in it.
Well, and okay, so it worked out very well as a segue because I want to talk to you about Black Cracker, your autobiographical novel.
Yeah.
And the book almost entirely takes place when you're just a young thing, under the age of 10, I think.
That's right, up until 10 years old, yeah.
You at the time, your family lived in Glen Cove, Long Island.
Yes.
And now this is where you're going to help me. Because the book says it's an autobiographical novel, that gives you a lot of license to
right,
some of it's
right.
Maybe true, some of it may not be true. What are the basics? You did go to school in Glen Cove, Long Island.
The book is it's very close. It's very close, but not completely. I took a little license. One of the reasons I did it. Everything is Rashomon. Nobody could tell the same exact story. Any two people are going to give a different version of something. You can't avoid that. That's human nature. There's no camera on you, you know, giving an objective viewpoint of it. So you have your own memories, which take on a life of their own. So I knew that. And at the time I was finishing it, writing it, was all this stuff was going on with writers who had been busted for writing memoirs that were discredited. There were like two different guys on Oprah who had bestsellers.
James Fry. And
they were busted. Somebody came out and said this didn't happen and he made it up. And I said, you know, there's no such thing really as a total memoir. It takes on – its memories take on their own life. Dreams take on their own life. And plus I wanted to fix a few little things that maybe didn't go as – quite as I wanted them in my life. So I changed, you know, you had to do compression mm-hmm. of time, you know, for the sake of getting a story told. You might have to change the sequence a little bit. I had to do a composite of one or two characters. So I decided to call it a novel, an autobiographical novel. It is my almost memoir.
So let's
most start. Of it happened. I stand by it and swear by it as it is 80% of it.
All right, so
change names, dates a little bit.
All right, so let's establish a little bit of parameters. So, grew up in Glen Cove, Long Island. Were you in fact the only white kid at an all-black school?
That's another point of contention. I remember a few white faces over the years. Okay. There was Drew, my brother, 2 years behind me for one, and there were two or three kids I remember over the course of 4 years. There were certainly periods of time where I was the only white kid in the school that I noticed, that I was aware of. There were a few Puerto Rican kids. I think in fourth grade, I was definitely the only white kid in my class. So there would have been, let's put it this way, the school was 99% black.
All right. And then one of the other things that was interesting to me, and I want to get sense of this, now that since I've gotten to know you and your dad and your brothers, I'm getting a little composite of my own. And you tell me if I'm off base here. My sense now that I've read Black Cracker is that your mom and dad were not really that involved with you, particularly you as the oldest of the boys. You were not that involved in what was going on in your life in grades.
I think they were. Yeah? I think they were, but I thought that's what all kids went through, what I did, going into the ghetto back then. I wasn't aware this was something my parents didn't know that. They knew, but it was okay. I was a wild kid. I was not like my brothers. My brother Drew was a stay-at-home kid. He was in front of the TV set most of the time. I was always out in the streets and just given free rein to go out wherever I wanted. When I was 8, 9 years old, my mother made me swear I would look both ways before crossing the street. And after that, I'm on my own. I was that kind of kid. Kip was not that way. Drew was not that way. So they knew I was involved. I was in trouble all the time. They didn't know a lot of things. I wouldn't have told them or thought to tell them.
Right. I mean, what I was thinking of is, I mean, I grew up, let's see, grades 2, 3, and 4, I would have been, let's see, I was in fourth grade in 69. So, you know, the late 60s. And I didn't grow up in Glen Cove. So, I mean, there's that. But knowing that your parents were, they did well, they were professional people, I got the sense that, unlike, say, my growing up over in New Jersey, where my parents, at that age anyway, knew everyone that I hung out with. I mean, you know, the kids came to my house. I went to their house. She tended to know at least the mom. Well, there was no sense in the book that your parents had any sense of who, you know, Bobo's parents were or lack of parents.
They wouldn't have known who the parents were.
Or Jeffrey.
And my father was at Magazine Management every day. He left at 7 in the morning and came back, you know, at 6 or 7 at night. He'd play with me every night and play catch and everything. But no, he wouldn't have known who my friends were, but my mother did, and Mrs. Sullivan did, our nanny who brought us up along with my mother. Mrs. Sullivan certainly knew all my friends, and she would shake her head in pity about how poor these poor colored kids, you know, Josh, do you realize how lucky, you know, you have food on the table and your clothes and these poor colored, and I'd say, they're not poor, who cares, they don't care, you know, I didn't pity that my friends at all. We were just all friends. We were all together. If anything, I wanted to live down there with them and be in that – live in what were beyond slums. I mean, it was a shanty town in my early years. It was a shanty town, and I thought it was really cool. And they thought my rich white people house was really cool. They said, "Yo, daddy must have $1,000, you know, when they saw my house.
Right.
So
but,
we
– But the other thing was
– my mother knew them. My mother – would give quarters to Bobo and say, you know, boys, have a nice lunch, go out to the diner, here's a dollar, you know.
So your mother, and I should point out that your housekeeper was kind of live-in for a good period of time. But so your mom knew the boys particularly that you hung out with, but for someone as young as you were in, you know, grades 2, 3, 4, every time your mother comes into play in the book, and again, autobiographical novel. I'm not. This is why I'm asking. You would forget about the kids you played with, and that they were poor and everything. Let's just talk about the housekeeper, who is Mrs. O'Leary in the book. Every time you try to point out to your mother what a mean and vicious bitch this woman is to you, everything goes ignored. The woman.
It was a silent scream.
Yeah, I mean, how
she,
could
how you were could, young. She amazingly, my parents did not hear the cries for help that Drew and I gave out for Mrs. Sullivan, who tortured us when we were young. Now, this is a woman that was with us that we knew for 20 years, mm-hmm. that came to us when Kip was born, and started out as a babysitter, a nightmarish babysitter, like the bad Mary Poppins. She was like Bette Davis in Baby Jane. I thought she was Baby Jane. She was like that. The first few years, little by little, she warmed up to our doo-doo jokes, and she became one of us. And by 1970, 71, Mrs. Sullivan actually smoked pot with me and my friends. She changed tremendously, and we grew to love her. Now, my wife does not forget. My wife didn't know her. Mrs. Sullivan died the year before I met my wife, and she thinks it's a horrid tale, and she would never forgive Mrs. Sullivan, but I do, and I was a wild kid. I was not easy to handle, but she was a secret alcoholic. We didn't know that. She drank sherry every night. It was under her bed secretly. She was probably hungover most mornings when she was acting, when she was abusive, psychologically abusive. She never physically abused us in any way, but it was a horror, and my parents did not. She was such a sweet old lady that my parents could not believe that Drew and I were telling the truth and thought they were tall tales. In any case, it's a moot point. We forgive her. We love her. We miss her. She became our dearest friend as we got into our late teens.
But so tell me this. So years later, you write this book, Black Cracker, and I'm guessing that this was the first book that you wrote?
Black Cracker was the first book I wrote, but it took me 35 years to finish it.
All right.
So I started it when I was in high school and finished it about 10 years ago.
So what did your parents think? I assume your parents, being very proud of you, read your book.
My mother was shocked. She read it four times. She couldn't believe that this was going on. I said, "You knew that most of this was happening." She said, "I did not." I said, "Well, come on, you know, then, you know, here you go, Mom, you know, swallow it up. This is what was happening. This is very close to what was happening. And I did used to tell you, and it would just, you were not, everything was, and my father's attitude was, look, everything worked out fine in the end.
Oh, God. I understand. I mean,
and he's right. And it did. Now, you know, the adults in Black Cracker are portrayed almost like in the Peanuts. From the waist up, they don't exist.
Yeah.
They're not real people. The only adults in Black Cracker are characters are adults who are like children. They're like arrested development children. There's Mrs. O'Leary's son, Drake, who we were very close to, who's like a child, in a 28-year-old child. There's Uncle Limpy, who's like might as well be a child. A few of the teachers are portrayed a bit, but it's the kid world. It's all the kid world. The adults are just like in the Peanuts. You just hear this, their white noise in the background, including my parents. They're not portrayed.
Right.
I did not portray my parents.
No, they're largely left out of it, except at those moments when they're not believing you and Drew in terms of
their white noise in the background. They're not supposed to be. This is the kid world, the white kid world and the black kid world of the early mid 60s, and how I perceive it and how I believe it was.
Well, and that's what I want to ask you about. This is where I'm guessing some of that autobiographical novel description fits in with your friend and his relationship with your teacher. Now, it sounds like something that, you know, I mean, I know in high school there was a teacher who seemed awfully close to a lot of the male students, and I know what I imagine years later looking back, but I mean,
I took it a little further.
Okay,
we would have a dance. We had a hot teacher in second grade. She was like a Jackie Kennedy girl, you know, a gum smacking Brooklyn accent. She was probably Jewish, but we didn't know what. She was just a white. All the teachers were white. All the kids were black. Uh-huh. But she was a young teacher. It was her first or second year teaching. She was very strict with a ruler, and you could see an electricity between her and Bobo. Bobo being the most misbehaved kid in the school, but her being quietly amused, secretly amused while she's punishing him. And I remember the memories of the dance that we would have a few times a year. Amy Grace protecting the house.
Thank you, Amy.
Amy, it's okay. It's just the postman. Go, Amy, go. So, I remember the dance, her getting down with Bobo and shaking her ass to the twist to the point where it was like, whoa, she doesn't dance to this music. This is a woman who sings White Christmas and songs like that, and here she is dancing and looking at him eye to eye, and he's, of course, like a little James Brown. He's in a suit and tie, a cheap suit, and he can really dance, and there's like something going on. And he gets to go under her desk when he's punished, you know, and you can't see what's going on under the desk, but there's her legs crossed, her stockings, and he's like in the corner, and she's kicking him here and there. So I put that in and maybe just added a little spice to it somewhat, you know, obviously.
All right.
I don't know if she really went to the beauty parlor to get his hair conked on the weekend or anything. You know, I added a few little deep things.
And do you have any idea what happened to any of those kids from
yes,
school?
Yes, they're all dead. Every one of them. Mm. I went back before, right around the time my daughter was born, and found that practically I found two surviving girls. And all of my classmates from the early 60s at South School in Glen Cove, from the up on the hill, as it was known, you know, are dead. They died in their 30s and 40s and even up to a few years ago. Why? Why is it that poor kids from a Long Island slum town who would now be 57 years old are, you know, maybe 80% dead, and I'm alive? What are the reasons? Does that say that coming from poverty really does curse you for the rest of your life? I think it says that, in a way. I had plenty of opportunities to die, you know, from drugs when I was a teenager, and but I had parents who loved me and were very supportive to me, even though it may not seem like it in some of what I've written. They were the most important thing in my life, and they were certainly – they may not have known every one of my friends or where I was going all the time. But in those days, kids in the Leave It to Beaver era, you went out and could go anywhere. You didn't – it wasn't like today. My daughter is not allowed – is 13, and she's never been able to play in the neighborhood. This is Dallas, Texas. It's the suburban area of the city. But you can't have – kids cannot go out on the streets alone anywhere in the United States, except for very small towns. And when I was 8 years old, I could ride my bike 5 miles away, and nobody thought twice about it. And so could a lot of my friends.
Sometimes you got on the Long Island Railroad and went into the city.
Well, that you weren't allowed to do.
Right, but you did.
I would have got big trouble if I was caught. Yes, a couple of times I snuck into the city, and that was really a daring thing to do. You get out at Penn Station and then run back in the train or something, and then go a little further another time. I did that a few times, but that was not with parental approval.
No, when I got to high school, certainly I remember doing a number of those things, and thinking back, and I've asked my mother, I said, do you even know where I was? And it's because I had a younger brother and sister. I was out there. I survived that far. They weren't tracking me as carefully, but I'm like you. I've got a 17-year-old daughter. Even now she's driving. I know exactly where she is,
right,
or she don't go nowhere.
Right.
So
it's a terrible loss that we cannot – that our children cannot have free rein on the streets. They can't play stickball out on the streets. Maybe they do in some neighborhoods in Brooklyn. They still do. I don't know. I know they do in very small towns in Texas, but not in cities and not in big towns. It's too dangerous for children.
Right.
Isn't that horrible?
Yeah,
awful.
I agree.
And it was not when it, or maybe it was when I sought out danger when I was a kid. But like my father says, everything turned out fine in the long run. So what's the, you know, would I let my kid do what I did when I was? No way.
Right.
No way.
Well, and of course, we didn't have the media in the way we do now, where everything is covered, everything is written about. We read about things that we never even dreamed of 30, 40 years ago.
We never dreamed of it, that what priests and nuns were doing to kids.
But it's been going on.
About. But it was that was going on too. Yeah. But look, that was in a safe place. What was going on in churches and play, you know, that those were safe places, which turned out to be not so safe.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let me ask you a little about the writer side of Black Cracker and other things. It seems like because of that upbringing, because of attending this predominantly black elementary school for several years, you have a basis of experience in your life that clearly sets you apart from your father's basis in terms of you had I give you credit for tremendous balls for going into writing in the first place, knowing your dad and his reputation and all the work that he's produced. But I think because of that experience early on and the way that you've gone, I mean, you've got a completely different voice and sound. I was thinking when I hear to be your voice in the books, I think of someone like a Nick Tosches, who is equally unique and deals with a lot of times, like in his Untold Story of Rock and Roll, for example. There's a similarity in voice and style that could not. No one else could have that voice because of experience or whatever it is. Is that I don't know where the question is here, but
I know where your question is. Yeah. Though when I was a young man and submitting stories, and I remember having a meeting without him even knowing that I was Bruce's son with Gordon Lish at Esquire when I was in my early 20s, and I got called in for an early version of Black Cracker that I wrote. He didn't know I was Bruce J's son, and of course he worshipped my father, or did then, or still does, I don't know. At the end of our meeting, it came up, and he went, "You're Bruce's son?" But then he gave me a lecture saying that I should be imitate. He says, a lot of other writers imitate your father's voice. He's had a lot of influence on writers. He's a writer's writer. Why don't you do it? You could do it more. I feel I could imitate my father better than anybody. I know where he comes from. I know his voice. And I do it in little pieces here and there. He's had a big influence on me. But I just went on my own track. Aside from my father, my greatest writer hero influences are Nelson Algren, Terry Southern, and the proletariat writers of the 1930s who wrote about my current favorite writer who I've discovered, who's been out of print for over 50 years, is Jim Tully. He was a very successful writer in the World War I and World War One years in the 1920s. He wrote about 15 books. He worked for Charlie Chaplin. He was the first writer to move to Hollywood in 1912. Wow. And he wrote scenarios for Charlie Chaplin. But he wrote books about the circus. He wrote books about riding the rails. He wrote books that were considered the first tough guy writing about the streets. I guess you can go back 1,000 years if you want to. But there's a certain American style of rough and tumble writing that he probably may be the first guy. And Nelson Algren seems to now come out of him. Jim Tully. He's a magnificent writer. Maybe not magnificent in sentence by sentence. It wasn't like he was, you know, he wasn't like Nabokov or Evelyn Waugh in his sentence construction. He was a man from the streets. So that's what I've always somehow related to. Is coming off the streets, like I said, like as a rich kid who spent all his time on the streets. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I will take my father's voice. Sometimes I will try and take Terry Southern, Nelson Algren's voice. Even Mario Puzo, my father's closest friend, was a big influence to me. His book, The Fortunate Pilgrim.
Great book.
A lot of his nonfiction books, as well as The Godfather. Mm-hmm. I always thought he was a great writer and great thinker and a guy from the streets, from 10th Avenue, from Hell's Kitchen. That's what I relate to. I don't know why. For some reason, I'm drawn to bad neighborhoods. I always have been. Black Cracker, bad neighborhood.
And Dallas thanks you for that now.
Times Square, Dallas and Times Square. You know. Take me to your slums. That's what I say. Whenever I get to a new city and somebody's showing me around, take me to your slums. I don't know why. I feel most comfortable. I'd rather sleep in a clean bed with clean I've had people book me in flea bag hotels when they had me on a writer's tour thinking, it's Josh Allen Friedman. He's going to love this place. And I say, get me out of here. You know, stuff. They think that's what I'm in. I said, no. That's just what I write about.
Yeah. let's be clear. Yeah. Let's be clear, fellas. Well, listen, I just looked and I think we're probably at that point where this will probably be the longest Mr. Media interview ever. So,
oh, geez. Well, I hope you edit it down.
We won't do that. But what I'd like to do is I want to get in one more song before we have to wrap it up. And I believe this song is This Radio Plays Nothing But the Blues. You want to just tell us something about this as you
another new
that?
Song. Okay. And you know how now that I've been a father, with a young daughter, and they take over the car radio. They're in the back seat, there are all these girls, and what are they listening to? Justin Timberlake and The Beeb and Miley Cyrus. You know, and for years I've been dealing with this, and finally I laid down the law and I said, I can't stand it anymore. I was losing my from now on, this radio plays nothing but the blues. Imagine a world in which every elevator you go into, every TV show you see, and every radio station just plays blues. Wouldn't that be nice? You know. BB's on Q102 saying hey. Freddy's on the morning zoo playing Hideaway. The sky is crying on the Weather Channel news. This radio don't play nothing but the blues. Got all my girls in my Honda AA, turning every station in frustration, you might say. Oh, Daddy, please make that black cat moaning stop. I said, you can turn the dial a mile, but it won't play no pop. Listen up, you girls, cause I'm laying down the news. This radio don't play nothing but the blues. NASDAQ quotes the seventh son of John the Conqueror. Elmore James on the range, it hurts me too. And Muddy's on the ticket, and you know he's a sporting man. So don't touch that dial, my voodoo child, it's coming out your shoes. Listen up, you girls, cause I'm laying down the news. This radio don't play nothing but the blues. This radio don't play nothing but the blues. This radio plays a lot of blacks and Jews.
Take that, teenage girls.
Take that, teenage girls.
That was great.
All new clues from now on.
Absolutely. I'm going to – oh, it's too late. I don't – my daughter drives her own car now. I can't lay down that rule. Where were you 2 years ago, damn it?
Right. She can now listen to whatever she wants, and it won't – you've got all the bliss you want. You've got your own free car radio now.
Yeah, but you know what's funny? When I get in the car with her and she drives, she controls the radio, and it just doesn't seem right.
Well, you see, that's why the song I just played you is a fantasy, because my daughter really does control the radio.
Oh, damn it. Did you have to say that?
I had to go to a Selena Gomez concert a few weeks ago. I had to take her and her friends. I brought the same kind of earphones you're wearing. They were Beats, and I blasted music from the Fillmore East from 1970 when I was her age, so I wouldn't hear it through the whole Selena Gomez concert.
I got to say,
that's a good father, right?
That's a very good father. The only two concerts I've taken my daughter to Bruce Springsteen, I felt like I had to take her to see him once, Green Day. And at Green Day, we actually ran into – this was the beginning of, I think, eighth grade for her. Her eighth grade English teacher was across the aisle from us. So I – you know, all the other stuff, her mom had to take her to. Those
see,
are the only two I did.
You would never find your eighth grade English teacher at the Fillmore East when I was 14.
I would
have been – that would have been the shock of the century to see such a thing.
I think that set a really good tone for the two of them for that year. I think that was the best year that she had. So that was good.
We have teachers that we love now. We didn't have that in the 20th century when we went to school.
In the last century, that's
teachers
sad.
That you know, teachers we stay in touch with of my daughters that we love. Who knew that such a world existed?
Well, listen. Is there anything that you would like to say, not to me, but to your father, your mother, your brothers, before we wrap it up here?
I love you. I love all of you. Thank you for being my family. Thank you so much for being my family. You're all wonderful.
And on that note, here's what I want to do. I want to have you back. I know you're working on a new album. So when you finish the album and it's released, I want to have you come back and we'll spend the whole time just talking music.
Do you mean that?
Yeah, no, I do mean that.
It'll be probably almost a year by the time it's out. Maybe a little thereabouts.
Perfect. So come back.
Look at that. I love the Mr. Media.
You come back and do that. And folks, listen, you can find Josh Allen Friedman's books, including I. Goldstein, Black Cracker, Tales of Times Square, a couple of comics-related books that he's done with his brother Drew, and of course other books by Bruce J. Friedman and Kip Friedman and Drew Friedman. Ginger Friedman, I believe, has a book on
My God,
on
it
acting.
Sounds like a dynasty. But it's not.
It's all out there in bookstores everywhere. You can order them right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching the video, you've seen a lot of covers go by. You can order all those at Mr. Media. And right now, if you're watching this on MrMedia.com, just below the video, either over here or over there, you'll see the cover of a couple of Josh's books. Just click on them. Take it to Amazon. You can download them or order them in print right now. Josh, website, Twitter, Facebook, anything you want to mention?
What do we got? We have – my publisher has a site for me called blackcrackeronline.com.
Okay.
Blackcrackeronline.com. And then there's Facebook, Josh Allen Friedman on Facebook, which seems to be the universal language these days. You know, a lot of people get in touch through Facebook.
It's true.
So it's not all that bad a thing.
No, I actually got to do a little prep for this interview by just looking up what you've been talking about on Facebook.
See, that's a perfect example. You know, great good things happen through Facebook.
That's
you know?
True. Even if the kids think it's passé, hey, who cares?
This radio this computer don't play nothing but blues.
There you go. Josh Allen Friedman, it was a pleasure to get to know you as it has been. All the men in your family. I think I have to turn my attention to women in your family, so you'll have to tee that up for me.
They're coming up. There's a few coming up, and you know they're young, and they're just, you know, in a couple of years.
We'll
gals coming up here.
We will be ready. Thank you so much for joining us in Mr. Media, playing your songs and talking about Al, and good luck.
Bob, thank you so much. And the reason I held out for a year or more not coming on your shows, I thought the rule was you had to drop trow when you came on. So I was a little nervous about that.
Oh,
you know, like in the porn world, we used to say, you know, if you had to drop your trousers, you know.
Oh, you're wearing pants? I'm not wearing
pants.
Actually,
I'm completely naked under the table here, and you know, I'll stand up.
Oh, okay, no, that's all right.
Okay.
Okay, more flesh than we've had on here with any.
But I'm very glad you didn't make me drop trousers. You know, I thought that was what you had to do on the Mr. Media show. So.
Yeah, no, actually, I'm glad you didn't either. And on that note, Josh, thank you very much.
Love you, Bob.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.